Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I will, with the utmost strength and dedication, work every day to protect and secure our homeland.
So the president tweeting out this confirmation that Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen is leaving.
Kirstjen Nielsen is out tonight as the Secretary of Homeland Security.
Leaving her position.
Resignation. That's one word to describe it, I suppose.
In her 15 months on the job, Kirstjen Nielsen became the face of controversial policies.
Zero tolerance and family separation.
This is just a very sad example of the dangers of this journey. This family chose to cross illegally.
We've never had a policy for family separation.
It is, I think, unconscionable. I think it is immoral. It's got to stop. And clearly she does not see the need for it to stop, so she should go.
She has been a disgrace, separating families, caging children.
And it's certainly our intention to reunify all families that are suitable.
We saw, even in children who were in shelters for very short periods of time, regressive behaviors, bedwetting, hurting themselves. I saw one child chewing on his arm.
President Trump wants to go in a tougher direction.
Kirstjen Nielsen, her name is against the wall, is an open border zealot.
The president berated Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen Wednesday. The president was angry she hasn't done enough to secure the country's borders.
I will, with the utmost strength and dedication, work every day to protect our homeland.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. A look back there at the rocky tenure of Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen. On Sunday, Nielsen joined the ranks of dozens of other cabinet members and senior officials who have offered their resignation to the Trump administration. Speculation of Nielsen's departure had swirled for weeks as the president continued to blame her for failing to adequately address migration at the southern border. But despite that, Nielsen was still the public face for many of the Trump administration's aggressive anti-immigration policies. She oversaw the zero-tolerance policy, which has separated thousands of migrant children from their parents at the U.S. border. Government officials said last week that it could take months, if not years, to reunite some of them with their families. And she oversaw the Remain in Mexico asylum policy change, which forced migrants to stay in Mexico while they wait for their asylum claims to go through. And that move was widely criticized by human rights organizations. Kevin McAleenan is the Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, and he'll be stepping in as Acting Secretary of DHS. We have two people with us now to take a look back at Nielsen's time in the role, as well as what might come next for DHS and the situation at the border. Jonathan Blitzer is a staff writer for The New Yorker who's written extensively about Nielsen. Jonathan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Leon Fresco is an immigration attorney and former deputy assistant attorney general at the Justice Department. Leon, great to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Jonathan, let's start with you. Nielsen's departure, we mentioned, had been rumored for months. What was the straw that broke the camel's back this weekend?
I think it was a matter of time. I mean, these rumors had swirled for more than a year at this point. And every time the president got enraged with the fact that more people were showing up at the southern border, the more likely it was that Nielsen was going to get edged out, even though, as you mentioned in your introduction, Nielsen made a real point of showing just how harsh and tough she could be in terms of border enforcement. But the president tended to blame her for broad regional trends in migration. And so given what we've seen in the last few months, and particularly last month with record numbers of apprehensions at the southern border, it became increasingly clear that her position was untenable.
Leon, let's bring you in here, because in 2019, we've seen twice as many migrants, but the increase here has been particularly among families that are entering the United States along the southern border. What does that tell us about how effective this administration's deterrence policies were?
The problem is that we've known since this started in 2014 that the regulatory changes that any administration would want to make to change this are not going to work. There are statutes and there are court decisions that give due process to people coming in seeking asylum. And so if there's going to be a change, it's going to need to be a change that's worked out on a bipartisan basis. And so the only changes that can be made now, I call them the three R's: rhetoric, recklessness, and results. And you're not going to get a change in results if you don't have bipartisan cooperation in law. You can only maybe have a change in rhetoric where the person sounds angrier and more forceful, or you could have a change in recklessness where the person actually starts disregarding the law and the court decisions. But if you do those changes in rhetoric and recklessness, then you jeopardize your chance of getting results, which is what you need. And you need that by having someone who lawmakers can believe in and negotiate a bipartisan solution with.
Jonathan, we mentioned in the introduction as well that Nielsen, of course, has been the public face for many of these this administration's very aggressive anti-immigration policies, particularly when it comes to zero tolerance. Nielsen has repeatedly denied that the Trump administration had a policy of separating families. Can you give us remind us about how she was involved in carrying that policy out?
Exactly. And I think it's worth keeping in mind the irony of Nielsen's tenure in this regard, which is that in an administration full of anti-immigration ideologues, Nielsen was never a true believer. She was an opportunist. And so the zero tolerance policy for her was a chance to prove her loyalty to the president and to prove her toughness to her critics within the administration. So basically what Nielsen has done since the start, since the initial announcement of zero tolerance in April and May of 2018, was that she has claimed publicly that the administration does not have a family separation policy, but rather that it simply tried to prosecute people who've crossed the border illegally. Now, obviously, this is misleading to the point of being just an outright and indefensible lie, because the idea of prosecuting these parents means very concretely that you'd be separating them from their children. And so through it all, Nielsen has tried to maintain that line up until the present moment, which has understandably got her into hot water with everyone, because she's been lying about one of the most grievous policies of the Trump administration.
And Leon, to bring you back in here, last week we said that government officials said it could take up to 1 to 2 years in some cases to reunite some of these children who had been separated from their families under zero tolerance. Leon, is that even legal? I mean, have we violated human rights at this point?
Well, I think the government has a duty, a constitutional duty, when, you know, we talk about you can't separate people from life, liberty, or property without due process. That certainly means you can't separate them from their children without due process. And here, saying 1 or 2 years, obviously what they mean to say is as fast as possible. Now, what they're trying to do is to get themselves in a position where the court doesn't start sanctioning people or throwing people in jail if they can't meet whatever deadline they gave. So they wanted to give themselves a deadline they could meet. But the problem was with the original sin, which was if you were going to do something that required parents to be separated from children, you needed to have a much, 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 much better way of accountability and rollout and processing and tracking and other guardians you can put people with, etc. If you were ever going to do this, I'm not saying you should have ever done it, but it needed to be, if something that serious was going to be done, it needed to be thought out much, much better. And so now, no, of course not. Saying you're not going to be able to reunite people for 1 or 2 years is not acceptable under any standard of constitutionality.
Jonathan, I'm also thinking, you know, Nielsen, as you mentioned, was essentially an opportunist here, but she still carried out a lot of the hardline immigration policies that the president wanted. Why ultimately would he turn against her? Is that just, we know that the president has a tendency to do that with people who don't fulfill his demands, if you will, but why here?
I think there are two answers to that question. The first is what you're already alluding to, that the president is so impatient in these matters and is so generally heedless and thoughtless in how he thinks about leadership decisions within his administration, that anytime there's complicated or distressing news to him, he tends to lash out at the person who's closest to the problem. So in this case, it was Nielsen. The second answer is a bit more complicated, which is that there are people within the administration, very influential policymakers within the White House, specifically Stephen Miller, but there's a cabal of other Miller-aligned anti-immigration ideologues who have the president's ear and have had the president's ear from the start of his presidency. And as more and more people have left the administration over the last 2 years, these voices have only become more extreme and more influential. And so anyone who is at cross purposes with the likes of Stephen Miller and others are, you know, have their days are numbered in terms of their service in the administration.
Where does that put Kevin McAleenan, who's the head of Customs and Border Protection, who will now be serving as acting DHS secretary?
It's concerning because McAleenan, by all accounts, is a respected, thoughtful administrator, someone who's served in Republican and Democratic administrations. And he has already, some of the things that he has said, for example, that the U.S. needs to invest more heavily in the region and Central America to try to address root causes of migration. These are already at odds with some of the things the president has said and done. And so, it obviously remains to be seen what his tenure as acting secretary of DHS will look like. But it's hard to imagine that he's going to have a solution to this problem that's plagued all of his predecessors.
Leon, are there any specific steps that DHS could take now that Nielsen is out, or is it really a question of following what the president wants no matter what?
Well, I think within the lawful framework of the court decisions and the statutes that exist, the administrative options are basically gone. There's a couple of things you could do with regard to reordering the way immigration courts work so that the people who are coming in most recently get their cases heard first. And with regard to then keeping those folks in some kind of monitored system so that you make sure that you are accomplishing a removal, if a removal can be achieved. But that's about it. I don't think there's really anything else you can do within your power to increase enforcement in a legal way. And that's why it's going to require, I think, a bipartisan solution that includes more things like refugee numbers and refugee processing centers abroad with a generous standard and hemispheric repatriation in exchange for some more enforcement abilities on the border. And I think that kind of deal can be made, but it requires a total transformation in how the parties deal with one another and the good faith that doesn't currently exist. And so that's what makes it problematic.
Jonathan, we've got a little less than a minute here. I'm just curious, what do you think Nielsen's legacy will be as we end the segment?
I think Nielsen will go down as one of the most, if not the most, aggressive secretaries of the Department of Homeland Security in the history of the department. And regardless of what her intentions were and regardless of what her thinking was when she was in charge of the department, the bottom line is she presided over the department at a time when it pursued some of its most heinous and aggressive and indefensible policies.
Jonathan Blitzer is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and Leon Fresco is an immigration attorney and former deputy assistant attorney general at the Justice Department. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
CBD. I've been seeing it advertised everywhere in New York City, in vials at the bodega, in fancy lattes, in ointments for muscle pain. And in technical terms, it's the non-psychoactive compound in cannabis. And it's marketed as a magic elixir, a cure for everything from insomnia to arthritis. But does CBD live up to all the hype? We'll get to all that in a minute with one science writer. But first, we're headed out of the studio to ask some New Yorkers what they knew about CBD.
I guess it's part of the marijuana plant.
CBD is supposed to be a stress reliever, and that's how they market it.
I've heard a lot of things, like stopping seizures from animals to infants. I don't know the technicalities of it because it doesn't personally affect me.
The trendy way to do things now is to put CBD in everything for health benefits. No one's ever told me the actual health benefits. They just keep saying there are health benefits.
Okay, so not everybody we spoke to could tell us exactly what CBD is or even exactly what it does. But a lot of you did tell us that CBD, in one of its many forms, is actually making a difference in your life.
I'm a runner, so I use it for joint pain and that sort of thing. And then also just with, sleeping better.
So I'm from California, and CBD has been around for a while there. I've tried CBD gummies and smoking the CBD oil, and I like it. It makes me sleepy a little bit and relaxed.
Some say it's hard to tell what it's actually doing.
I tried it and I didn't really see any effects though, so I'm not really sure what the big deal is. I guess it's supposed to kind of mellow you out, but I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I think they're pretty, they're tasty, they're flavorful, they're kind of catchy. The packaging's cool, but I haven't really felt any sort of difference.
And still others told us they just weren't that moved to try CBD.
You know, I have tried other products, you know what I mean? And what is stopping me from trying CBD oil? It's not accessibility because you can find it at Walmart. You know, maybe it's, you know, the stigma stuck in my subconscious mind, you know, somewhere back there, that it's not like formulated as a product.
I don't do marijuana, so that's basically why I don't feel the need to try that.
I've never tried it. I mean, I'd be open to, I just never have. I feel like if somebody was like, hey, do you want to try it? I would just be like, sure. But I haven't so far, no.
I don't know. I didn't feel compelled to buy them for whatever reason. But I would try it if someone offered it.
No one ever offered it to me. That's a reason a lot of people gave us for not trying CBD. Even though it's available in so many different forms at stores and restaurants and coffee shops, there's still something about it that makes it seem like it's a recreational drug, probably because of its association with weed. But one barista at a Manhattan coffee shop that sells a bunch of different CBD-infused products says that's changing.
There's still a large amount of people that are still unsure of what it is, so which is to my surprise. But yeah, they're only getting more popular.
She says she gets a lot of questions about CBD, and the way she described it, it sounds like people are almost treating her like a pharmacist at a drugstore.
Yeah, the basic question is like, how am I going to feel? Like, what am I going to feel like when I take this? I'd say it's a relaxer, so if it's your first time, you will feel relaxed later on throughout the day. As far as like the health benefits, I think they only work if you take it consecutively. Like if it's like a consecutive amount, maybe twice a day, every day, but just like a one-time thing, you'll just feel relaxed.
And we should mention that though it's widely available, CBD food products are still illegal under U.S. Food and Drug Administration rules. Various local governments, including New York City, have blocked sales. The New York City Health Department told The Takeaway that it's currently informing businesses of the law and has allowed some leeway for compliance, but will start issuing fines on October 1st. CVS and Walgreens recently announced that they would both begin selling CBD products in select stores across the country. Here is CVS Health CEO Larry Merlo on CNBC talking about the rollout.
Anecdotally, we've heard from our customers that, you know, have used those products that, gee, it's helped with, you know, pain relief for arthritis and, you know, other ailments. So we're going to walk slowly, but, you know, we think that this is something that customers are going to be looking for and is, you know, part of the health offer.
But as availability explodes, how much do we actually know about what CBD does to our bodies? Laura Sanders is with me to talk about all this. She's a PhD in molecular biology and a reporter for Science News. Laura, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
In preparation for this interview, there's a deli near WNYC, and I bought a CBD brownie. Just right off the shelf, $9. It promises to change my life. And before I take it, what is CBD?
It is a molecule found in the cannabis plant. So that includes both marijuana and hemp. And I referred to it as the straight-laced cousin of THC, which is the psychoactive molecule that gets you high in marijuana. So CBD doesn't do that.
I was going to say, that's the fun part, isn't it?
Well, yeah, you know, I think because of that, though, that it doesn't get you high, CBD has really captured people's attention for its purported health benefits in a way that's really taking off, as you know.
Let's talk about some of those benefits, because as I mentioned, I did do research here and bought this little brownie, and it says right on the front, it says may help with pain relief, anxiety, relaxation, arthritis, and chronic pain. But it then says CBD's health benefits are still unfolding for many indications. So what is it good for?
That's the question. And unfortunately, there's no answer yet. As you know, there's this long list of things: insomnia, anxiety, pain, acne, even really serious diseases like cancer and Alzheimer's and substance abuse disorders. But the short answer is that we just don't know yet what it works for. There's one case, and that would be the epilepsy studies. An approved drug, FDA-approved drug, found that CBD does curb seizures in some rare pediatric epilepsies. Beyond that, though, the questions remain.
So is it snake oil?
It's too soon to say. I mean, really, it's scientists are interested in it. There are hints from the literature, the scientific studies that have been done, that it might work against some of those things. It's just too soon to say. So the evidence right now is pretty slim.
My brownie, once again, says that it has 50 milligrams of something called full spectrum CBD oil. What is that? And is 50 milligrams a lot?
So the best data on dose comes from the seizure studies that have been done. And in those cases, the children, many of them were getting around 1,000 milligrams a day for effective doses. Here, you know, the things you're buying, as yours is 50 milligrams. I bought a bottle of water that had 5 milligrams in it. And I calculated I'd have to drink over 200 bottles of that water to get the same dose as in those FDA-approved studies for epilepsy. The other answer is that we just don't know how much you should take, assuming it works for any of these things.
Okay, so who's regulating this, if anyone?
That is an excellent question, and it's a really murky area. The FDA is involved, and so they've maintained now that CBD is not a supplement because it's been approved as a drug, you know, in the epilepsy case. So because it can't be a supplement, that means you can't make health claims about it, you can't add it to food, you can't sell it as a supplement. However, as you know, that's a huge problem because here we are with CBD available everywhere. I think FDA is starting to recognize that mismatch, and just recently they've announced a public hearing to talk about this problem in hemp-derived CBD and what might be done going forward to regulate it, because now it's really piecemeal. You may have seen there are some local efforts. So in New York City, the Department of Health there recently banned CBD products from being sold in restaurants and is getting huge pushback. There's also efforts in California and other states where kind of local entities are stepping in to regulate CBD, where, you know, in this kind of void of regulation from the federal level.
Is CBD something that anyone should feel safe picking up off the shelf like I did today with this brownie?
There are reasons to be cautious. There are reasons to have, you know, the buyer beware mentality. You don't really know what you're getting. It could have THC. There's probably THC in your brownie if it says full spectrum. There could be other things. There was a case in Utah of a synthetic cannabinoid instead of CBD that actually sickened a lot of people. So there's no telling how much CBD is in there. There was a study in 2017 that found a fewer than a third of products they tested had the accurate CBD amount as what the label said. So you've got a lot of questions about what you might be actually getting.
We entered this conversation really thinking about CVS and Walgreens that have announced that they'll be selling CBD in some stores across the country. Should consumers trust those products if they go to CVS, Walgreens, and they pick up Tylenol and CBD and tissues? Is that going to be the norm going forward?
I would remind people that there's pretty skimpy research on this, and there are caveats with it. That said, if you're using it as an acne cream or, you know, a lotion or something that has different kind of risk-benefit ratio calculations than if you're using it for cancer, I think that the second case is a lot more concerning. And I'd encourage you to talk to your doctor and figure out, you know, what might be a better strategy for you.
I had a doctor actually say, have you tried CBD?
A lot of physicians are not opposed to it. I talked to some pain specialists who mentioned a lot of their patients were coming in saying that they had taken it. And about half reported they'd felt a little better. And the doctors I talked to were saying, you know, we just don't know why, if maybe that's a powerful placebo effect. But the fact is that these anecdotes are powerful. And I think that's why scientists are pretty eager to figure out more about it.
How do you think the sort of growing acceptance of CBD, particularly in the commercial space, will impact research, what you all are doing?
I think it will push it forward. I think scientists take cues from the public in a lot of cases. The bigger factor, though, I see here is the availability of CBD for researchers. So with the passage of the 2018 Farm Bill, which made hemp legal federally, that opens up a big source of CBD for researchers to study that they didn't have access to before. They've been kind of hamstrung, and I've talked to a lot who had really hard times getting CBD into the lab to study. So now, you know, hopefully that will kind of open up access and researchers can get their hands on it easier.
Laura Sanders is a PhD in molecular biology and a reporter for Science News. Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we conclude our show today in Florida at Mar-a-Lago, President Trump's private club in Palm Beach, a place that the president has frequently promoted throughout his presidency.
Thank you very much. It's been a great honor to have the Prime Minister of Japan and his extraordinary wife with us tonight at Mar-a-Lago. Many of the world's great leaders request to come to Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach. Just a special place, and somehow it makes people feel good. And that's good for our relationship.
Like many presidents before him, Donald Trump has made use of a private residence to get out of D.C. Harry Truman had a getaway in the Florida Keys. Ronald Reagan had his ranch in Santa Barbara. But unlike his predecessors, Donald Trump's retreat also happens to be a business, one with nearly 500 paying customers. And last week, a woman who was not a member misled Secret Service agents in order to gain access to Mar-a-Lago. She was carrying a number of electronic devices, including a thumb drive that contained malware. On Wednesday, the president tried to downplay the incident.
No, I'm not concerned at all. We have very good control. We have extremely good, and it's getting better in cyber. Frankly, what we're doing with cyber is a story in itself. No, I think that was just a fluke situation, and I think that the person sitting at the front desk did a very good job.
The incident has raised serious security questions about Mar-a-Lago and highlights Trump's unique hybrid role as businessman and leader of the free world. Joining me now to help us understand all this is David Farenthold, Washington Post reporter covering President Trump's businesses and conflicts of interest. Thanks for being with us, David. If anybody knows about this, you do.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So let's start with the news, the latest news on this breach. What do we know about the woman who tried to enter Mar-a-Lago?
Well, she says she is a businesswoman from Shanghai, and she said that she had flown from Shanghai to Florida to attend an event that night at Mar-a-Lago. And indeed, there was an event that night at Mar-a-Lago for which a bunch of tickets, I think, had been sold in China. So that part of her story is plausible. It doesn't mean that it's true, but at least she was referring to an event that seemed to exist. But the reason she was regarded as suspicious was that she gave several different stories. She said she wanted to go to the beach club. Then she sort of intimated that she might be the daughter of a member of Mar-a-Lago. And then finally, only after she was sort of caught, did she talk about this event.
You have most likely been to the White House for reporting events. I've been there. There is a lot of security we have to go through in order to get near that facility. What is the difference here with Mar-a-Lago? I mean, are there security protocols that failed?
What you have to remember here is something you alluded to in the introduction. This is an incredibly difficult environment for the Secret Service to police because there are so many people coming in and out of it every day. In addition to the 500 members and their guests, there's also, on some days, hundreds of more people who are complete strangers who are coming to charity luncheons or galas at the club. But because there are so many people there, you just multiply the opportunities for there to be a mistake. You know, somebody who's left off the list who feels a right to be there because they've paid their dues or paid for their ticket. And so what they've created is a system of exceptions. Yes, there's a list and you got to be on the list. But if you're not on the list, you can get in anyway if you talk to Mar-a-Lago security and they know you or they think there's a reason you might be there. And it's that system of exceptions that allowed this woman in. She wasn't on the list. But she said, well, my name is Zhang. And they said, well, this is Zhang, who's a member here. So maybe are you his relative? And she sort of nodded uncommittally. And then they let her in. So by creating this culture of lists, but also exceptions, that's where the mistakes could be made, and certainly where it was made in this case.
And is the Secret Service responding?
The Secret Service says, look, our job is to protect the president physically. You know, nobody can get within arm's length of the president without us stopping them. So we even within Mar-a-Lago, we protect him, we protect a smaller sphere around him. But the question of who gets into Mar-a-Lago, yes, we help with that, but that's ultimately the decision of the club and not us. So they said, look, you know, in this case, if there was a mistake, it was made by the club.
Have there been any other security breaches or close calls at Mar-a-Lago that we know of?
We know of a few instances. The New York Times reported on a couple of them. One person got in and like smeared bananas all over the place. And another person got in and changed all the screensavers on the Mar-a-Lago computers. This is funny, but it's a bit worrisome that they were able to get access to the Mar-a-Lago computer system. Broke in, changed all the screensavers to read expletive Trump.
I had not heard about that last one. How is Mar-a-Lago different? We mentioned at the top that presidents have often used residences outside of the White House to get away from D.C. What makes Mar-a-Lago different? Is it that it has this mix of sort of paying customers, if you will, and is not a private residence per se?
That's right. I mean, presidential retreats in general were private residences, but with an emphasis on private. Think about George Bush's trips to the ranch in Crawford, Texas. These were isolated places on purpose. They wanted to go someplace where they were kind of alone. And so for the Secret Service to protect those places, it was, you know, some staff, some media, some family and friends. A few people were allowed in and out of this secluded place. Mar-a-Lago is the opposite of that in every way you can think of. It's extremely busy. That's on purpose. Trump, to make money off of it, needs it to be busy. There need to be people coming in and out every day.
And I'm also wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the actual security threat that this woman may have posed, either to not just the president, but to potentially to the country.
I think the two separate questions, the question of her physical threat to the president, it doesn't seem like there was any sort of plot by her to harm him. And as we said, there's a number of layers of security around him beyond the one that she got past. The question of, could she have been a spy? Could she have sort of installed surveillance devices? Could she have overheard conversations? Could she have watched the routines of the president and his aides? Yes, of course. Anybody who gets past the reception desk at Mar-a-Lago, which is where she was stopped, could observe all that. We don't know if that was her intention, though. A lot's been made of this malware on her thumb drive. A lot of us could be carrying around viruses and malware on thumb drives we don't know about. Just the fact that there's malware doesn't mean that she was a spy sent to plug that into the Mar-a-Lago computer system and control everything.
Another twist in this is that last month we found out about Cindy Yang, who was the massage parlor owner who was selling Chinese citizens tours to Mar-a-Lago that may or may not have guaranteed access to the president. What does that tell us about Mar-a-Lago and its sort of ongoing, you know, relationship with folks from the outside and within the presidential service? As well.
It tells us two things. One, Mar-a-Lago does not seem to be doing much of anything to control who has access to Mar-a-Lago other than taking their money. The other thing about Mar-a-Lago is it shows you how much the place has changed because of President Trump, because he drove away so many of their old customers. I mean, when President Trump took office, the galas and banquets and luncheons that Mar-a-Lago had in its ballrooms were sort of the old kind of stodgy pastel-colored Palm Beach events they'd had for years and years and years. But after Charlottesville in 2017, where President Trump said, as you recall, there's many fine people on both sides of those violent protests, including violent white supremacists. I think more than 20 of Mar-a-Lago's old, you know, reliable, stodgy Palm Beach customers left. And so it created this hole, which has been filled by kind of weirder events, more startup events that don't have the same customers that are mainly aimed at just super fans of Trump.
What dynamic does that do? Does that create, David? I mean, beyond the potential spy elements here, there seem to be bigger questions about how much the price tag is to access power directly with the president.
That's what's really interesting about this is that Trump doesn't come to all of these events. And if he does, he doesn't often shake a lot of hands, but he does sometimes. And so what people are able to do is to sell access to the president's club and, you know, possible access to the president to people who are just, you know, they could be from anywhere. As long as their money's green, they can get in. And so there's been events and some other galas that Cindy Yang exploited. Maybe other people have exploited too. Cindy Yang's one we know about, who saw this as a chance to just sell access to the president.
David Farenthold is a Washington Post reporter covering President Trump's businesses and conflicts of interest. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.